Hey, thanks for tuning in to this episode of You Really Shouldn't Have. Just a quick warning to say the following episode does contain some strong language, which some listeners may find offensive. Thanks and enjoy the episode. Ian, thanks so much for joining the show today. It's really great to have you here.
Yeah, pleasure to be on, James.
Now, I don't normally do an intro at this point in an episode. I normally do the intro and then we cut to the interview, but I feel that I should probably give some sort of context, give them the reason that you're here, and then I'll hand the mic over to you, as it were. So I often get messages from people expressing an interest to be on the show, and you dropped me a message, but I wasn't quite expecting the opening line of your message, which I'll read, which was, "What if what I really shouldn't have is brain cancer at 31? And you know, yeah. I just thought, you know, fuck, you know, because it really hit me on a personal level solely for the reason that I'm 29. So, you know, I'm only 2 years younger than you. So it was like, shit, you know, this guy is pretty much the same age as me. You're obviously here to talk about the work you're doing and your fundraising off the back of that diagnosis, which I think we'll build ourselves up to. I wanted to go right back to the beginning, if you don't mind, Ian. What was early life like?
I had the happiest childhood ever. I absolutely, like, every time I look back, every so often my mom will ask, like, when she'll watch something like, I don't know, Angela's Ashes or something sad, where, like, about, like, a sad Irish childhood, and she'll turn to me and be like, now tell me honestly, did you have a good childhood? That's like, it could have been written better in a book. Like, I don't have any unfond memories.
You're born in Ireland, obviously, but you moved over to London. In your late teens, early 20s?
So that was because when I first left university, I studied computer game development, hence why I'm still a gigantic nerd playing computer games at 31. And I hated that just because there was no creativity whatsoever in it. It was just, I expected to come in and then tell me, okay, you have, you've got to be creative in some ways. You've got to come up with new ideas, work through problems. And it was just, you're going to be a coder, and that's all you're ever going to do. Anything to do with sort of art you would think of is just going to be broken down into graphics, and it's just going to be more coding. You're not going to draw pictures. Not that I was ever a good artist, but you just this is what you are. And I was like, no, not having that. And off I went. Then I studied paramedic science over here, well, over in Ireland. And then when I got that completed, I then didn't have access to a job, which was kind of expected in Ireland at the time because of the recession. And then I wanted to look around. So I was like, all right, let's look at other countries. And so I didn't have the balls to go to Australia. So I was like, all right, well, let's start off small. Let's go to the nearest point. So I looked into universities that were training or just jobs that would be available. And the NHS were paying for the funding for studying nursing. So I then thought to myself, all right, well, that probably isn't that different from paramedic science. And then when I actually went there, I realized very quickly, oh my God, this is unbelievably different. It's completely different. And as a paramedic, you go in and, you know, you're your own boss for better or for worse. So if you, it ends up with a lot of shit days, but it also ends up with a lot of massive satisfaction. And with the nursing, what I found was that there was just so much paperwork constantly, and I'm dyslexic and just dislike bureaucracy in general. If there's an efficient way to do something, I will, like a cut corner way or anything like that, I'll always try and find that way. And there was just so much paperwork to do that I hated it, but I stuck through it for 3 years. And then eventually when I had to do my dissertation, I then finally said, no, this isn't the case of you just being a quitter. This is that you made the wrong decision studying this, and you need to leave now because you're never going to enjoy any part of your career. So then I went and I studied something that I was passionate about at the time, which was still am, which was just fitness stuff. So I studied sports science in St. Mary's in Twickenham, which involved me. I had already moved to London, but this was now a university within London, and St. Mary's was brilliant. Again, similar to the whole kind of childhood thing, that it was just loads of people were in a small area and really friendly. And at the time, people said, oh yeah, the population is only 1,500 to 2,000 people. And I originally thought, oh, that means that's a lower chance of me finding people that I'll get along with. But it's actually the opposite, because you're walking around the area all the time and you're bumping into people on a regular basis. So you get to know loads of people. It was hard to go from one classroom to another because there was about 60 people that I ended up like slapping hands with and hugging and all this sort of thing. And be like, all right, I'm late. But then there's like, you know, 20 more people who I enjoy the company of that I'm going to have to walk past. And yeah, so that was the reason that I moved over, and that was my sort of last education. That's how I got involved in working in the fitness industry. Still am, kind of.
So where did you go from there? Once you'd finished your fitness qualification, what was your next step?
I think I was already working in some form of job that I had on the side. I think I started the longest job I've had, I still have it, as soon as I'm finished my treatment, which is tomorrow. Tomorrow's the end of my chemo and radiotherapy, which I'm very much looking forward to, because
fantastic.
It's draining. It really caught up with me. I didn't think it was that bad at the start, but the doctors were right. It caught up with me. It compounded. And Go Mammoth was the first job that I had, I think. Oh, wait, no, Fitness First, but I've stayed with Go Mammoth. So they sort of make more sense. And what they do is they run sort of basic sports, you know, like sort of five-a-side football, touch rugby, volleyball, dodgeball, like just sort of things that people can do that it's not overly competitive, but people do want to win, but it's mostly more about the social side of things.
Yeah.
And that was brilliant for me, because I ended up working as a referee for ages now. I think it'd be over 5 years. And because it was on a Saturday, the people would show up for the first match and then hang around a little bit more. And everyone was just the biggest whore and slut ever there. So you'd end up playing for like, you'd be the substitute and the ringer is what it's called, for several different teams, because some people would be like, oh God, like I only have 3 team members today. We need 6. And then other people who just played be like, oh yeah, I'll drop in. And what ended up happening was everyone got to know each other really well. And the group it's quite tight. And because everybody lives near each other, everyone invites each other to parties and on it goes. And now there's a big bunch of friends that you'd kind of, it feels more like what it was like back in university days and high school days, where you live near all your mates.
I wanted to move forward towards your current situation. And am I right in saying that it was all triggered by a medical trial that you took part in?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, I used to always do medical trials just because I never really liked... in the fitness industry, there's very few 9-to-5 jobs. And a 9-to-5 job is something that is, like, not appreciated for how much its value is, because it's brilliant when your friends are going out on a Friday night and you're able to as well, because you're all singing from the same hymn sheet in terms of time schedules. And the fitness industry is terrible for that. It's almost the opposite. So weekends, it's always, you're expected to work weekends and you're always expected to work evenings. That's when you teach fitness classes. And so my job was always peppered around. So it would be like I'd be getting paid a large wage per hour, but I wouldn't be working that many hours. It would be running classes. And so I would then sign up to medical trials, which would, I could take and leave the classes as much as I liked. I had quite a lot of autonomy, which is great. And then the medical trials, you could only do them every 3 months, because they need to make sure that whatever was in your system is completely out, and you can now be considered as a control patient. So they need to be able to say that nothing else influenced your medical outcome. And so I would do them all the time, because it's a great way to earn money and it very rarely is unpleasant at all.
What sort of stuff were you doing?
One of them was a HIV vaccine, and I didn't even have to stay overnight ever. I just went in. They gave me the vaccine. I had no ill effects at all. I wasn't told I couldn't do anything differently. So like, you know, can I... I didn't have one at the time, I don't think, but like, let's say I had a girlfriend and I wanted to start a family. If it was like, oh, can I still have sex and, you know, try to start a kid? And it was like, yeah, everything's fine. It doesn't affect your sperm. And then all of that, absolutely clear. And then all I had to do was give blood every week once. So I go in 15 minutes, they take the blood, off I go. And then I got paid something like $3,000 for doing, I think, about 30 or so blood donations.
Oh, wow.
So it was a lot of money for very, very little work. It was essentially getting paid. If it took about 15 minutes for me to walk to the hospital and to do the treatment and then come back. So
it's a pretty good hourly rate.
Yeah, it was about 400 quid an hour for what I was doing, because it was, and actually, no, it was even more than that, because, you know, your hourly rate doesn't include your commute. So yeah, it's crazy money. And I ended up going to Peru off that payment. So yeah, it was brilliant. But the one that I got this discovery over was I went in for one, which I was actually going into that because I had lost shifts in work that I was very pissed off about. So it ended up me going in with this medical trial, and the medical trial was about schizophrenia medication. So they said, we have to do an MRI and make sure that everything is absolutely clear, no problems whatsoever. They did the scan, and then I got a call saying, you actually have what's called a benign tumor in your head, in your left temporal lobe. And so I was like, okay, benign, that sounds good. Mm-hmm. Tumor, how dangerous is that? And he was like, a benign tumor, they're quite common. You do need to keep an eye on them. You'll have to take some more medical tests often within your life, but you're limited a little bit, but not much. So I was fairly relaxed about that. And then there was just a kind of a muck-up with COVID coming in. I couldn't get my second appointment. And so that's when it started to kind of escalate, because I should have got my second appointment within a couple of weeks, and it ended up being half a year just because it wasn't deemed as an emergency whatsoever, because it was, when they first looked at it, they said, this looks benign. So it, and also for a man my age, it was like, okay, we've detected the tumor, but it's probably not going to be growing at a 31-year-old's age. I think I was 30 at the time as well. So that's probably been growing in his head for, you know, 6 years or something. But
shit.
Yeah, they don't know. They have absolutely no idea. Like the doctor, the guy who was the surgeon, his name is Tim Jones. He was saying to me, like, we haven't a clue what brought this on. So don't start looking back and thinking, oh, did I have my phone to my ear too much? Did I do too much cocaine? Did I not do enough cocaine? Like, you know, don't try and find the reason for why this has happened. This has just happened to you. And then once the second scan was done, he was like, all right, that's growing. It should not be growing. It's growing very fast. It hasn't changed how it looks. So we need to like get in there and try and cut out as much of it as possible while still maintaining your brain's integrity as much as possible. Otherwise, when it does change from, like, let's say yellow to red, if it changes from yellow to red, then you're in real trouble. But as the piece of paper is expanding and getting larger, it's not that dangerous to you.
So then from there, I imagine next it was surgery.
Yeah. So that was surgical time. He gave me the option. He was like, you could not do it, but it's the stupid choice to have. And so I was like, all right, well, you're the doctor, you know, you're not going to be just sort of fiddling around with someone's brain because that's your favorite thing to do. So yeah, let's do the surgery. And he was like, yeah, okay, cool. Well, because he was said to me, are you right-handed or left-handed? I said, I'm right-handed. And he goes, okay, well then the area of the brain that it's in is going to affect your sight and your ability to speak. So, and I was just there like, oh shit, like I really like those two things. They're really handy. And he was then saying, okay, and what we are going to have to do, the best way to do it, you have the option not to, but the best option to do is something called awake surgery, which is, no anesthesia. You got to go straight in. They can give you a local anesthetic.
Yeah.
But something that they didn't really mention to me, they said like, oh yeah, your brain doesn't have a nervous system in it, so you won't feel anything that we're doing. But I still felt like the pressure from them like grinding open my skull. And he also, normally with brain surgery, some people get that window where they can go under for when they're drilling open your head. But he was saying that because it's spoken surgery, the spoken part of my left temporal lobe, he said to me, yeah, when you come back out of the anesthetic, you'll sound like you're drunk. So it's probably better if the whole thing is awake. And I was just like, oh, for fuck's sake, I don't get any respite with this one. And so he started that, and that was a really bad squeeze. Like, they didn't tell me that I was going to experience that. So I was there kind of like, you know, singing a song to myself to just try and like, oh, just by the time you get to the end of this song, it'll probably be over sort of thing. Sticking to the lyrics and trying to concentrate on that. And then afterwards, I had to constantly speak during it. So it was, which one is a cat? Which one is a dog? Where do they both sleep? And, you know, that sort of thing. What's different about these two animals? What's the same? Which animal is bigger than this one? Those sort of tests the whole way through. But near the end, it was more my hips that were annoying me because I had to do it on the side.
Ah, okay.
So, oh God, it was so bad. It was like, imagine being in a box and not being able to move because there's just no room.
And how long was the procedure in total?
So I think the brain part was 3 hours. I think the cracking open of my coconut was, I think, 1 hour. So I think three and a half or four.
Wow, that's a long time to be on your side.
Yeah. Believe it or not, that was definitely the worst part. It wasn't the, because they have a local anesthetic. So it was more the disturbing feeling of them. Like when they have to get your skin to flap off, like, I don't know because I didn't look and I didn't want to look and I don't want to know in another way, but it felt like they really had to get like a chisel and just go like to grind the flap of skin or flesh off the bone and then get it to move over. So like just feeling that, it was like, oh God, I can feel the razor or whatever it was on my actual skull. It's not like, it's not painful, but it's just, you know, I feel like I'm a piece of wood here.
So then after that procedure, what was the timeline in terms of, you know, the procedure is done versus them giving you the diagnosis?
So that was, I think it was maybe 8 days or a week. So it was while they did that, they had I went in for an MRI. So the surgery seemed to be successful because afterwards, it's quite good the way your speech deters, because it goes down, but it also goes up very quickly. So it's this wave effect, but that comes and goes within hours. So while you might be having a bad moment where you can't say simple words, I couldn't say hospital for a while at one stage. I had to do a workaround and say, it's not a hostel. It is a hostel where people are sick.
Wow.
And yeah. And another one was, I couldn't say where I was. I could say, we're on the ward, we're on the hospital ward, but I knew the word ward only by my second name.
Yes.
And even as I was saying it, it didn't feel right. So it was very alien, this feeling of, I know that's the correct word, but I have this feeling that it's not. I'll tell you one thing else that was absolutely fascinating. This negatively blew my mind, absolutely like send me off the walls. When one of the nurses came in to do the daily checks, where they just ask you, do you know where you are? Do you know what your name is? Do you know what day of the week it is? They came in and I was playing a computer game at the time. And it was like, you know, again, requires fairly intense cognitive ability. So it was a game like that where you build a base and you kill your enemy and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah.
So he's doing that. So like a lot of thought is needed in that. Playing it well, it's doing fine. They come over and they ask me. And then at that point, I'm like, where are you? I'm in the, fuck, where am I? I know where I am. I know exactly where I am. My house is there. Like I could tell people like, but you go out and you go this way, you go to the left, you go to the right. But then I couldn't word St. George's, that was just like, is it Georgina's hospital? Is it Gary's hospital? Starts with a G, I think, or is it a J? Like, it was from being like, you know, perfectly functional in to what I thought, and then to being in like nowhere's land.
So you got the diagnosis, which I know they've said to you is between 1 and 5 years, isn't it?
Yeah, that was so my speech bounced back very quickly. They said that it was only going to be, it was going to take about 6 months to a year. But because I'm young, they have no data, or very little data on people who are my age, because it just doesn't happen that someone both gets a tumor young, but more importantly, it's a billion times more rare that they get the check, because when you're young, you don't have medical problems. So I didn't do any of that except for, most people my age don't do any of that for no reason, but I kind of did it for no reason. And so the Tim Jones, the surgeon, he said that I was one of two people that he ever encountered that stumbled upon a tumor randomly no symptoms, they call it asymptomatic. When I went in for the second meeting, I wasn't expecting this at all. I thought they were going to be like, oh, well done, your speech has improved dramatically. So, like, you know, that's a good sign. That's the thing that we were most worried about. And then they were like, you've got stage 3 tumor in your head. We've done the biopsy. And again, we know we've said this before, but it's not what we expected. So, they didn't say you got 5 years to live. It's a rule with doctors. I don't know worldwide, but definitely here, where they don't tell you unless you ask. But the way they were kind of speaking, it was like, it doesn't sound like it has a long ending. This is more of a film short than, you know, one of the classic epic films. So I then asked, like, you know, how long we got here? And I regret asking that so much, because my mom was in the room with me.
Oh.
Yeah, if I had known that, I would have been like, I'll ask when I'm on my own.
Mm.
But I don't want mammy hearing this one. Oh. And she's a champ. She's an absolute champ. So she held it like a champ. And she was just sort of like, oh, shit. And then instantly went into problem-solving mode, as she does. And options mode as well. And then what they also mentioned was a particular reason that we haven't said anything with you is because you are 31 and we don't have data on how accurate that normal 5 to 6 years is taken from a sample from people who are twice your age.
Yeah.
So that's when you're twice your age, it's the time when you get tumors, but it's also the time that, because people that age get tumors, they tend to get random checks, even though they don't have symptoms. So then they were like, so you got your speech back within 6 days when we were expecting it to be 6 months. So we don't know if that means that you are going to live till 60, but on paper, you got 5 years. I don't have a lot of symptoms.
No.
There's some issues with my hair loss at the moment with the treatment, but that's due to grow back. And I've kind of gotten used to the mohawk look anyway. So even if it doesn't, it's like,
you're rocking that mohawk. You're rocking that mohawk, I have to say.
Oh, pushing it hard, man. Pushing it hard. I've got like a big dirty scar on the side of it as well. Now it's like, don't fuck with me territory.
Now, I mean, if I got this kind of diagnosis myself, Ian, I don't know how I'd react, what I would do. You've taken it upon yourself to not just try and break one world record, but two world records and raise a lot of money at the same time. So tell us a little bit about what you've been doing so far.
Brain cancer affects the brain, not the body, luckily enough, until you come to the end cycle of it.
Mm-hmm.
But so I was like, all right, well, you can still do physical things. So let's look into physical things. Marathons, they're always there for charity. I wonder what the most amount of money anyone's ever done with a marathon. And then it happened to be someone who had run in London as well. And I've run the London Marathon a couple of years ago. So I was just like, straight away when I saw this, I was like, oh, this is perfect. This is a sign. This is like, you know, the world record holder held it in London. He's held it for a while. And you know, 2.7 million, that's a lot of money. That really is. But it seems feasible. It seems like if you put the hard work in that you could get that, you could hit that number.
Absolutely.
And then I then thought, all right, well, how fast did he do it? And I don't think I got a result. I wouldn't say he's an old man, but he's getting on in his years. His name's I keep mispronouncing his second name. I don't know if it's Chalk or if it's Chalky, but his name is Steve One or Two. And he's a class guy. He's a great man. He's broken his own charitable world record. He said it once, broke it once, broke it a second time.
Oh, wow.
So he's done it. Yeah, he's done it three times. So he's well versed in this sort of stuff.
No pressure, man.
Yeah, I mean, if I get this, I'm probably going to start having, like, you know, a heavyweight championship with him, because he's going to be just like, all right, well, if you want to throw hands, son, I've got the experience. So yeah, that'd be pretty fun if that started happening. That'd be deadly. And then yeah, so I thought, all right, that's so perfect. And then I also knew that you can break city's world records with them. With marathons, if you go dressed as something.
Yes.
So then I started looking up, all right, well, what could I dress as? And there's one for, like a patient, which I think I'm going to break anyway, which was for 3 hours, 47 minutes. And my best time was faster than that.
Oh,
so
okay.
I was like, all right, well, that's very doable. But because it's very doable, it's like, yeah, you know, it's not that impressive. It's very doable. And then I kept digging. I found video game character. And I was like, oh, I wonder what that's like. And it was sub 3 hours. It was 2 hours, 56 minutes. And that was like, oh, bollocks. Like, that's hard. That's really hard. But then I was sort of breaking it down, being like, all right, could you do that? You're 6 foot, 1.5, and near 100 kilos. Could you do that? Like, how are you going to? How fast would you need to go? How fast would each kilometer need to be? And it, which is a sick answer, it's 4 minutes, 15 seconds per kilometer.
That is,
and you got 42 of them to do.
And I guess it depends on the weight of the costume as well. I guess it depends which character you go as.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot. Some people have suggested, oh, you should let the fans choose when you have fans. And I was like, fuck no. They'll say things like Mario or Sonic, and how am I going to be able to run? Like, Sonic would be fitting because he's, you know, a fast hedgehog.
Meant to be fast, yeah.
Yeah, but, like, you know, no way could I wear a Sonic outfit. The guy who won it, he went as Link from Zelda.
Oh, yes.
Which, if you think about it, that's pretty doable. You know, you just put on a green t-shirt, a hood, you know, wear some leggings and then a vest over it, maybe a kind of a brown belt. Like, I don't think that would hinder you too much.
No. Oh my God. Now, it's come to the point in the show, Ian, where I have to ask you, what is the worst gift you've ever been given?
Oh, yeah, I thought about that. And it's kind of fitting for what I'm pushing here, but... Two years. I think they were back to back. My parents for Christmas gave me the gift of giving. And I was young at the time. I was like 10, maybe 11. So you don't give anyone a gift of giving, because that's like, it's the biggest fuck you ever. And they when they gave it to me, they were like, you know, you're getting older. It's about time you sort of like started looking at the world a little bit. And I'm here like, you know, I got you makeup. Yeah, that's for you. You get to enjoy that. And it was like, it made me feel so terrible, because it was like, oh my God, you really are selfish shit. You know, your parents got you a prosthetic leg for a child who had walked over a landmine. So it's like, there's no way you're allowed to be annoyed about this.
No.
There's no way you're allowed to be annoyed at that. No way. You're the world's biggest bastard if you're annoyed at that. But the more I thought about it, I just couldn't get it out of my head. Like, why did they give me, like, why didn't they let me do that myself and feel good about something that I did? I was here expecting, like, you know, a new PlayStation or something, a football. And here you go. Here's a piece of paper. Then I think I remember even breaking and telling my parents, like, all right, look, I know you meant well, but that's a really bad gift. It just is. And they did it a second time, except no. I remember the second time it was like, here's a goat that you give to an African family, and then the goat will provide milk and all this sort of thing. So they'll be able to be, it's a sustainable resource essentially. And it's like, oh, what? Like, you know, again, you make me give again. I've gotten you two in a row now. Four in a row if you count both parents.
So, Ian, wrapping up, where can people go to find out more about you, what you're currently doing, and most importantly, how can they donate?
Yes. So if you got, I was an idiot and I got loads of little creative names for all my various Twitter account and my Facebook account and my YouTube. And regrettably now, because I'm started doing podcasts and I got this big, long list of things that I've got to get people to remember, but I got a domain name yesterday. So you're nice. The first for this one.
Nice.
So if you go on to curecancerordietrying.com, and then go to the about section, you get links to, if you want to directly donate to the charity, then all the Just Giving pages are there. If you want to have a look at what the Facebook is like, or what the YouTube channel is like, again, they're all there as well. If you are someone who wants me onto your own podcast, or someone who wants to sponsor, or has an idea, there's an email thing there, but that's more for, I haven't found the right word yet, but like, think of it as a business email, even though it's not a business.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's kind of sort of becoming run like one in a little way. So yeah, that's the way to do it. You can read the rest of the website if you want, but I wouldn't, because I was very, very tired while I was making that website and I just wanted to get through it. And I found that the only way that I could get through it was to just start talking mad shit and like writing the most ridiculous things I could think of, because they have a carbon copy website for whatever you select. So I selected, non-for-profit organization. And it's all this sort of, our team, what's our mission? And it was just this bullshit. So I wanted to go the complete opposite way. So I was like, what's my mission? To take over the world and run it with an iron fist of tyranny and fear. You know, I just started writing all this shite. So just go to the about me section. And those are the links to the actual channels that are taken a bit more seriously. I wouldn't say much, but a little bit more seriously.
Well, Ian, it's been fantastic having you here. I wish you the very best of luck with the world records, and I really hope you break them. I'm going to keep an eye on you, see how you're getting on.
Yeah, that'd be great, man. Next time I'm in a bit more of a some progress, I might try to get in touch with you again.
Absolutely. It'd be a pleasure to have you back on. Ian, thanks so much. Take care.
Thanks for having me, James.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of You Really Shouldn't Have. Be sure to subscribe to us on your chosen podcast service to make sure you never miss another episode. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram @BadGiftsPod, as well as online at badgiftspod.com.